Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, and Jim, it was obviously a very difficult weekend and starting on Friday, and we'll get to that a lot in the second martini. But as always, good news, bad news, crazy news for conservatives, and we start with really good news. It's not a surprise, but it looks like Nikki Haley has finally made her choice in South Carolina as to who will replace Jim DeMint, who is resigning his U.S. Senate seat from the Palmetto State to take over as president of the Heritage Foundation. Most conservatives immediately and instinctively pushed very hard for the promotion of Tim Scott from the 1st Congressional District to the newly opened Senate seat. I don't know of a single conservative that thinks this is a bad idea. He's only been in there for one term, but he's a guy who has already established himself as being right when the critical decisions are before the Congress. And so if you have to lose Jim DeMint, having Tim Scott to take his place is not a bad fallback position.
Some years from now, we may even come to see it as an upgrade.
Right.
Tim Scott is a guy who has a zero rating from just about every liberal organization. The Planned Parenthood, NARAL, People for the American Way, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a down-the-line conservative. Also worth noting that he won a tough, very contested primary back in 2010. It was a fairly Republican district back then, so it was kind of safe that once whoever won the primary had a very good chance of winning in the general election. He won that. Then the district lines were redrawn. South Carolina was getting another Senate seat. He ended up going much further to the southern part of the state, the low country that my parents live in, includes Hilton Head and Beaufort County, and they love him down there. So he's always been a you know, very charismatic speaker. For most of his speeches this year, discussing the need to vote out President Obama, he tended to close by singing "Hit the Road, Jack." This is a guy who always, you know, has a great deal of energy and excitement and enthusiasm for the job. And I think, you know, South Carolinians are going to be pretty darn happy with him. The favorable, unfavorable numbers of Public Policy Polling found earlier this month was 47% favorable, 13% unfavorable. Now that leaves 40% who aren't sure. They're probably representing, you know, other parts of the state where they aren't as familiar with them. But I think this guy is definitely going to be a person to watch. Now, he could get a primary challenger 2 years from now. You also might see some of those folks thinking about challenging Lindsey Graham 2 years from now. But I think Nikki Haley did herself some good. I think she did the conservative movement some good. There's been a lot of bad news for folks on the right lately, and Senator Tim Scott might be the best news we've gotten since Election Day.
And you mentioned the primary he won a couple of years ago. Not only did he win a contested Republican primary, he beat the sons of Strom Thurmond and Carol Campbell down in South Carolina. So that means you've definitely been able to get your message across, and it's a message people like. So that'll be necessary on the Senate floor and across the state when he's up again in 2014. But congratulations to Tim Scott. It's an excellent choice. Congratulations to Governor Haley for making that choice. On to martini number two now, and what else could be the bad martini than the ramifications of the horrific slaughter of innocent children in Newtown, Connecticut on Friday. 20 children, 6 adults, the shooter's mother before ultimately taking his own life as soon as he knew police were on the way. Just horrific and tragic and tear-jerking in every conceivable way as you watch this entire community try to come to grips with all this. Unfortunately, and probably not to anyone's surprise, literally the bodies were still there and not all that cold by the time that a lot of people on the left were already talking about new gun control legislation. Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, lead among them. But by the time the Sunday morning chat shows rolled around, you had all sorts of folks like Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Schumer talking about assault weapons bans and all this sort of stuff. On the roundtable that I saw on this week, Jim, you had Democrats, and this is seemingly more and more common. They think the Second Amendment is there for hunting. I'm not sure why they think that, but that's always their caveat. We respect hunters, and so we have to preserve the Second Amendment. They don't realize why the amendment was put there in the first place. But the immediate politicization of this in our current 24-hour cycle, I'm sure it's on some level unavoidable, especially in the Twitter universe. But, man, it's just hard to watch all of this vitriol play out when you have these families just heartbroken.
It was particularly disturbing. I prefer to live in a world where the first responders refers to cops and ambulances, not to who can get their press release out first. And there were some members of Congress who were putting out press releases while on Friday afternoon. One other, kind of you touched on this. It was really depressing to see. Maybe expect on Twitter in which the conversation is open to the world, then inevitably there'd be some person who decides to deal with this most awful of circumstances by saying that their political opponents have blood on their hands. Right. And I was lucky enough to get a couple of those emails throughout the weekend. But also even on Facebook, watching friends, how quickly any comment about this horrific massacre turned into a discussion about gun control, and it quickly turned into a quite nasty discussion on gun control, and that it turned into, you know, the one side accusing the other of attempting to use a tragedy to further their political agenda, and the other side accusing the other side of abetting murder by supporting the Second Amendment. And I just, you know, whatever you come down on gun control, and I think I'm pretty well established as a pretty across-the-board opponent, with one exception I'll get to in a second, the discussion got nasty immediately, and it just kind of turned into this. It's interesting how we can't discuss these things in any type of format that suggests a respect or common courtesy or empathy towards the other side, and the idea that the other side might be feeling as you know, heartbroken and angry and bewildered and as much as anyone else. In fact, I guess it's probably even more disturbing when the most unthinkable thing in the world happens and everyone's first reaction is, well, this assures why my political agenda is the right answer. It might be better if we had a little more introspection at times like this. I mentioned the Morning Jolt today. The one gun control proposal I'm thinking about, and it's not to say, a lot of people said I endorse the idea, I'm touting it. I'm wondering about the ban on extended clips. A good portion of the mass shootings we've seen in recent years involve those extended clips. I understand the Glock is the standard, most popular handgun in America right now is the Glock. That carries about 19 rounds. I'm curious if there's anyone who believes that their ability to defend themselves depends upon the ability to fire more than 19 rounds without reloading. And if so, I feel very bad for you to be in a circumstance where you need that. I'm wondering, every one of these, the fact that so many of these shooters have used this makes me think this is something that should be examined. I have no illusions that this will prevent all gun shootings. I have no illusions that this will instantly make the world a better place. However, I do wonder about whether this means that, you know, the next time there is a mass shooter, the person will need to pause and reload a little bit sooner than they do under the current circumstances. Anyway, from that, I'm already being accused of being a Obama supporter, a Mike Bloomberg, et cetera, et cetera. So knee-jerk on these discussion of these issues, it's really frustrating. I have gotten a few, I'm going to say, slightly more even-toned and respectful missives of opposition, and I appreciate those. But the fact that this has turned into a, you know, we see people lashing out at the world through random violence and killing, you know, innocent people and kindergartners. And it seems like many people trying to make sense of the world do so by lashing out at people who have nothing to do with the shooting. We are a society that really seems to thrive on conflict. And people look for reasons to lash out at people who disagree with them. And it's just not healthy at any level. And it just kind of seems like an accelerating cycle of this rather than any type of calming or moderation or deceleration of it.
The tone has been awful. I think the smartest man in the room on Twitter on Friday was your colleague Ramesh Panuvar, who said, in a situation like this, I'm pretty confident Twitter will only enrage and not enlighten. I'll see you all later. And he got out of the whole forum there and just came back at another time. I think that was probably the smartest decision I saw on there over the weekend. But the one thing, and I agree with you, going after the Second Amendment is not the right answer here. The one thing I would love to see, and I don't know that there's an easy solution to this, is making sure that people who are documented to be mentally disturbed not have access to weapons. But I'm not sure I want the federal government doing that. But I would love to see a way where people in this young man's condition and other people who just turn into these savage killers don't have the opportunity. But given the circumstances in these cases, it's hard to know exactly how to do that since his mom leaves.
An ideal solution, yeah, it's an ideal solution in theory, but much more difficult to actually enact in practice. And among them, the privacy issues and the notion of the government going through your mental health records is, you know, a lot of people have a lot of very legitimate objections to that. So,
absolutely.
Anyway, this is really awful. an all time worst bad martini, Greg. Give me something genuinely crazy to cleanse the palate.
We'll be glad to. Well, last week when we did our three martinis on Friday before we knew of the tragedy in Connecticut, we were talking about the likelihood that since Susan Rice had withdrawn her name from contention as Secretary of State, that your good friend John Forbes Kerry, who served in Vietnam, would likely be the nominee. And now we saw reports over the weekend that he is, in fact, the president's choice. And that means that, once again, Deval Patrick, thanks to the new law that they rushed through and Ted Kennedy died, gets to appoint a senator before there would be a special election. And he wants a caretaker, unlike Nikki Haley. And Jim, I don't know if you know of any other Greek immigrants who could enact a robust furlough program that could be completely unemotional in almost every public setting. But Michael Dukakis, the former governor, nearly 80 years old, is supposedly on the short list for Governor Deval Patrick to be the caretaker for about 4 months until the winner of the special election is determined. So if John Kerry as Secretary of State and ruining America's diplomacy for the next 4 years wasn't enough to whet your appetite, Michael Dukakis back on the public stage should pretty much top you right off.
You know, Greg, I'm very proud. I like to think that my John Kerry impression of Friday triggered your excellent Michael Dukakis impression. I know you've had that bottled up on the shelf since 1988.
I have.
Looking for a chance to use it, and it's fantastic. You know what really kind of surprises me about Dukakis? I mean, like, there are a lot of reasons to be stunned by the political return of Michael Dukakis and just the very concept of Senator Dukakis. He's been teaching at UCLA for a whole bunch of years. I don't even know if he's lived in Massachusetts for a really long time. And the reason I know this is that a friend of mine by the name of Flint Dilley lives near the campus of UCLA. And Dukakis got into some sort of controversy over how they park. And I guess it was the idea they're parking diagonally instead of along the street in order to make up to be more space efficient. And somehow this turned into this huge controversy on the UCLA campus and, you know, town-gown relations and stuff like that. The great parking space controversy of like 2007 or 2008 or so, and Michael Dukakis was right in the middle of that. And I remember looking at that and thinking, boy, you're 1988, he's looking pretty good in the polls, you know, you think you're going to be the next president of the United States, and it doesn't work out for you. And within a few decades, you're fighting over a parking space out in Los Angeles. But, you know, the wheel of fate never stops turning, and who knows, maybe, you know, he'll get to – well, you were talking about having a placeholder in the Senate. Michael Dukakis is a man who can hold a place. That much we will give him credit for. I mean, some people are probably exclaiming, why not just leave the seat vacant at that point? But we will see if it comes to pass. I almost kind of hope it was just for the sheer comedic value and the raw inspirational passion that that Michael Dukakis will bring to the floor. I hope Bernard Shaw gets that first interview.
That's right. I'll tell you, as a Greek kid, I'm so glad he lost. I would not like to have my people associated with him for the rest of my life. That was a good thing for America and for me in so many ways. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.